You're listening to Geek Jabber Live, the show where the main host has a face for radio and a voice for silent movies. Strap yourselves in and dial up the disappointment. Welcome to Geek Jabber Live.
Yes, welcome to Geek Jabber Live for episode 2. We're stupid enough to give this a second shot. We've got myself, Tim, over here, and we've got the usual culprits joining us. Over in Sydney, we've got Nick, and over in Sweden, we've got Qwerty's. Hello, you two.
I can't believe it's episode 2 already.
Yes, already. Yeah,
it's like yesterday.
It does feel like yesterday. Shit.
Yeah, so yes, we are stupid enough to give Geek Jabber Live a second run for its money. So let's see how this goes. This episode, we are going into retro computing and retro gaming and all things from the ancient past of whenever.
Whenever. I think it's safe to probably say we're going back to the 80s.
Yes.
The 80s and 90s.
Yes. So, well, that sort of kind of leads into what I was sort of going to bring up as the first topic, which is, you know, a lot of people talk about retro technology, but, you know, where's the cutoff? How are we actually defining retro computing and sort of in what context?
Well, look, personally, I tend to think that retro tends to come before vintage. I know a lot of people say that, you know, things are vintage. But, you know, personally, if I'm thinking about vintage computing, you know, I'm thinking about the 50s and the 60s and, you know, those sorts of early computers or calculators. But talking about retro computing, I think it has a much broader sort of sense in that it sort of encompasses technology well into the 80s, 90s. You know, obviously it's 2021 this year, but, you know, it comes down to the individual as well, because you've got people out there that never have heard of the Pentium or MMX and things like that. So,
yeah,
I think that would be retro computing to them.
Yeah, and yeah, it's sort of kind of interesting because I sort of had a realization when they were talking about like Windows XP still being used in some systems, even fairly recently. And I just realized that, you know, Windows XP is technically about 20 years old now.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, there's even stories of OS2 Warp being used in some very niche embedded solutions. And, you know, that's even older. So, and the majority of listeners have probably never heard of OS2 or OS2 Warp. And, I think that very much fits in with the retro computing definition.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the way I kind of define it, at the moment, it would basically be everything before about the year 2000. Because I think, the reason I say that, sort of going back to the Windows XP thing, the fact that it was still sort of in use fairly recently.
Well, it's quite modern, really. Like, you compare it to a lot of the operating systems like pre-2000. I think XP is actually quite polished. And, you know, if you were to throw a user today who knew not of retro computing and put him in front of Windows XP, I think they could find their way around it quite easily. But then you start talking about things like Windows 3.1 or MS-DOS or, you know, the various versions of Linux and things like that out there, I think that'd be quite lost.
Yeah, well, I think the other reason I say that is that seems to be a turning point. So that's where the old Windows 95, Windows 98, Windows MP, so that era of computing was really starting to wane. And we were now moving into Windows XP, which sort of thoroughly modernized.
Yeah. So I have to ask Tim, where did you start? What was your first OS?
So my first OS, at home, it was a Commodore VIC-20.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was that old. So I sort of, my cousin upgraded to a Commodore 64. So I got his old VIC-20. So that was our first computer at home. Our first actual PC was a 386 SX16 in 1992 with a massive 4 megabytes of RAM and an absolutely unheard of 60 megabyte hard drive.
Wow. And that's in a 386?
That's in a 386.
Wow. It would have been a cost a pretty penny back then.
Yeah, that was actually like, that was actually a reasonable machine for the day.
Absolutely.
So I think we should ask QWERTY, what was your first machine that you remember?
Well, the first gaming machine was an old Amiga, I think, was down I was a bit handicapped because I grew up in a Mac or Apple family, so it was a different Apple computer.
That's
so...
all right. We won't hold that against you.
No. Yeah, still bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the whole PC thing, I kind of missed it until I ended up in the uni.
Yeah, but I think QWERTY's, you raise a good point though, because I think a lot of people's first foray into computing was actually the gaming console. And you're talking about your Sega Mega Drives and Ataris and things like that. Although Atari, you could argue that it was, you know, close enough to a PC. You could do word processing and, you know, those sorts of tasks on it. But most people didn't touch computing before games, and then after that.
I have heard the Commodore 64 described as a console with a keyboard.
Yeah.
An interesting side note, because I was talking about retro computing with someone earlier in the week, and I was actually reminded of something. Now, I'll start this with, what is the oldest, on the topic of consoles, what's the earliest console you can actually think of?
Look, I think I'd have to probably go back to, you know, the Sinclair Research machines, like the ZX Spectrum. That's probably the earliest one. And I think we'll probably take this time to just acknowledge Clive Sinclair, or Sir Clive Sinclair, I should say, who sadly passed away 2 days ago. Yeah, 16th of September, Clive Sinclair passed away. He was 81, but he was an amazing inventor, and he was an inventor of computers you know, electric vehicles and things like that as well. So, but the ZX81, the ZX Spectrum is probably the early one that I remember, as well as the Sharp MZ800. I had one of those growing up as a kid, which was a Z80 based machine.
Yeah. So, QWERTY, when talking about these consoles, what's the earliest one you can think of?
Oh, an Xbox something in France.
A little bit later. The reason I say this was, you know, I was talking about doing this episode with someone, and he actually said I should check my my parents' place, because I think we've got a one of the old Magnavox. Consoles in there. And I think that is, it's not sure whether it's the Odyssey or the Odyssey 2, but I was sort of looking at it. The Odyssey is from 1972. The Odyssey 2 is, I think, about 75. And I'd completely forgotten that machine even existed. I've got one. And I basically said, if you could get that working, that would be worth an absolute fortune now.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, a lot of those machines from back in that, I mean, it was certainly before my time, but they just don't survive. Like, a lot of people, and even with later machines, people just toss them in the bin when they became obsolete, and they didn't think that they would have future value. Like, the machines from back then are completely different to your normal beige box PCs that you could build at any computer store.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And one of the things that, you know, if you remember that early 80s before everything became standardized, you sort of realized that there was essentially the computer wars. So there were some people that like the Commodore equipment. There are some people who like the Spectrums, who like the Acorn stuff, which is...
Yeah.
And
to be fair, you've still got that these days. And yeah, look, I guess this would be a topic for another episode, but the whole Windows 10 versus Linux thing seems to be heating up quite a bit.
Yeah.
Something that surprised me is I was reading a bit about Clive Sinclair and the influence of UK in computing. I mean, how much of the early computing came from the UK?
Well, the interesting thing is, like, I talk about having, because I actually have two BBC micros. One is the earlier Model B, which is, I think, 1981, 82. The other one I've got is a Master Compact, which came from 86.
Amazing.
The story behind that machine was sort of towards the end of the 70s and going into the early 80s, the BBC... So a British Broadcasting Corporation realized that computer technology was actually going to be the next big revolution. So they wanted to have a series of TV programs to teach people the basic concepts of how a computer works.
Yep.
And they wanted to have a machine to go with it. And they basically had put together a spec sheet of what the machine had to have. So it had to, had to have sort of be indestructible. It had to have a good version of BASIC that was good for programming. It had to have, be expandable. They had a list of requirements of what was for stuff we now take for granted, but for the day was actually a really impressive machine. And the only people that actually could provide that was Acorn, and that was a machine they had in development. So that's the machine they were building became the BBC Micro, which they used to help teach people computing. And that's how that kind of got into the schools, because the BBC were using it for teaching. So it was really a big education machine from the early 80s.
And I believe that's sort of where programming started to become introduced into teaching, like especially primary school and high school teaching. It obviously started with things like Logo or BASIC and things like that. But then I remember when I went to school, we were learning, Visual Basic and HTML and things like that, like the things that came way after that. So. You're right. Like it all really started from those sorts of early machines, and it just snowballed from there.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, it sort of brings up another point, because there has been, sort of moving on for that, there has been a bit of a revival in the retro computing. So they're now releasing things like the Commodore 64 Mini and the VIC-20 Mini and the SNES Mini. So basically... what they've essentially done is taken something like, I think, Raspberry Pi or whatever hardware they decide to use, and basically run an emulator on top of that. And it sort of raises an interesting point, because there is that revival of the equipment. These machines make it very convenient to introduce people to that level of hardware. But there's also the argument to be made that... there's some value in actually running the original hardware as it was, when it was available. So that sort of raises an interesting question.
I think, and you're sort of leading towards emulation here, and there's all sorts of emulators out on the market, and I think the one that most people are familiar with is the old DOSBox emulator, which lets you emulate MS-DOS and play the old DOS games. But I think we need to remember too, like a lot of this old hardware, they were produced in such limited numbers. And to buy a lot of this stuff these days is prohibitively expensive. Like a lot of people can't afford to buy it, or if they do, they're not going to be able to maintain it. So I think emulation is a really cost-effective way to run the old software the way it was intended to be run, but on modern hardware.
Yeah, and you know, there are also people like me that also like the challenge, like of having the original period hardware.
Absolutely, yeah. I think for those that have the technical skills, like absolutely, like there is a massive retro computing fan base out there, and there are still products available for purchase on eBay and sites like that. But and look, there's even producers of that. There are people producing modern hardware, so brand new I/O cards, for example, which emulate the old Adlib card, sound cards and things like that, using older chipsets. But you really need, well, you need to have deep pockets, but you also need to have the technical know-how, I think. It's not just point and click.
Yeah, well, sort of on that note, there seems to be sort of a plethora of other options to make modern hardware sort of work with the older stuff. So I know, for instance, for my Commodore, one of the early investments I made is a device known as a Zoom floppy, and the idea is that it connects up to my USB port. I can hook up my Commodore 64 drive via this interface and get a disk image and write it out to a real floppy disk that the Commodore can use. So I can use my normal computer to basically write disk image. You've also got like the SD card storage as well.
Yeah, which is becoming quite popular. You're finding, even with PCs, you know, into the 90s, old IDE hard drives and SCSI hard drives, if you're talking about the Macintosh, they're not making them anymore. Like, they're not being produced. So therefore, you're relying on old stock, whether that stock's been used or not. Really doesn't matter, because they've been sitting on a shelf, they've been wearing out, and those hard drives won't be around forever. Like, you really need to start looking at ways to interface the new with the old.
Yeah,
preserve data from old hard drives, floppies, zip drives, I think was a thing once, and that you can migrate it on. But that's where emulation comes in also.
Yeah, but I mean, emulation only goes so far. Like, if you do actually have the hardware, and a lot of times the hardware actually works quite well, it's just that the storage device has stopped working, whether that be the floppy drive or the hard drive or whatever. I think it's important to keep that evolution going and find more modern ways to interface into the old...
I think one of the other challenges is the actual media itself. So back in the early 80s, the 5 1/4-inch floppy was king. That later became the 3.5. And the fact that, you know, you get bit rot. So, you know, the drives are... unless they've been stored in perfect conditions, you know, the media just tends to degrade over time and becomes unreadable.
Yeah, and look, and bit rot was certainly a thing with even modern technologies like optical media, CDs and DVDs, things like that. Bit rot would settle in quite quickly, actually, if you didn't install things properly. But even then, they had a finite life. With the retro computing drives, you're typically relying on magnetic storage, like hard disk drives and things like that. Bearings wear out, motors wear out, you know, things dry up. They won't go forever.
Yeah, but it also sort of raises an interesting topic of abandonware. So for those that don't know, sort of abandonware is sort of software that's, you know, basically not in active use at the moment. So old versions of games, of applications, they tend to be collected on what are known as abandonware sites, where you can download them. The problem is they tend to sit in a little bit of a grey area, in that the software is still technically under copyright. they're just not likely to enforce that copyright because there's no commercial value in doing so.
Yeah, that's right. I think you raise an interesting point. And it's not just that the software is technically copyrighted still, but you'll often find with a lot of these applications is, you know, the original developer or the company that developed the software has become defunct. They don't long exist anymore, or another company has bought the rights to it and have just decided to discontinue the product. So in both those sorts of cases, I think you find it hard-pressed that they're actually going to come after, you know, copyright infringement on really super old software. Like, what's, you know, eventually it comes down to what are they actually losing out on in terms of actual losses, and that'll be determined by court. But you don't see it, and they just tend to cut their losses, I think.
Yeah, because I think the other part of it is, you know, if Microsoft were to, for instance, go after someone who's wanting to use Windows 3.1, and they don't have a license, you know, they're going to get a lot of bad PR because, you know, why are you going after someone for something you don't even sell anymore?
Yeah, well, actually, Microsoft is an interesting example. They actually released the source code for a lot of old products they developed, which is completely unlike Microsoft. You don't tend to get a lot of source code out of them. But I believe MS-DOS and the old versions of Microsoft Word were released along with Microsoft Basic.
I think it was, I remember MS-DOS 1.25. There might have been MS-DOS 2. There was Word for Windows 1.1.
That's right, yeah. And then you've got the source code to the old Microsoft Basic or MS Basic interpreters as well. So, like, that sort of stuff is being released by companies. I guess you could argue that, you know, Windows 3.1 or Windows 95 or Windows 98, they're long obsolete. Why don't they release the source code there? Well, look, it is their property, but what value is it?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much right. I think that's why it tends not to be pursued, is because there's no commercial value in actually pursuing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's also, I was thinking, old games. It's like, in a way, it's like old books, that it's cultural value also.
It comes down to the country as well. Like, different countries have different copyright laws. You know, we in Australia have our own Copyright Act, whereas, you know, if you go to America, you've got the DMCA. You could argue that the DMCA doesn't enforce itself in other countries, but I think the US tend to think otherwise. So you run into all sorts of those legal arguments and things like that.
Yeah.
I think, by the way, a short shout out to the chat, Geekyabber chat in Discord, if you're not following it, or Geekyabber.
I'm sort of watching it because I've got Mr. Nika, who is apparently listening along and playing along at home, and yeah, he made the comment that apparently Nintendo do sometimes still sue for old games. Apparently.
I guess, though, with a lot of the old games, it's a franchise they like to hold on to. Like, despite, you know, a lot of games being developed for things like the Game Boy or Commodore 64, and they're long dead for the most part.
Sometimes they revive it. I was thinking, like, Quake, like, it's an ancient game, but now you can play it on download and play it on your computer again and play multiplayer.
Absolutely. And look, you know, you speak about Quake and games of that, and I think Wolfenstein 3D is like a great example of that. Like, I remember playing that as a kid. Like, I got a demo floppy disk of Wolfenstein 3D, but you know, there have been various ports, and you can still play that today.
So that nicely fits into our last topic, because I have been playing a little bit of Wolfenstein 3D, so it is available It is available on Steam and Game Pass. The Xbox version. I haven't seen the Xbox game, but the Steam version at least is basically the original Wolfenstein 3D. And they have repackaged that with DOSBox, so that you can run it fairly easily on modern hardware.
Yeah, right. It's been many years since I played Wolf 3D, but I was never one into games, but you guys are probably more au fait with that stuff.
Well, what I loved about it, it's not... there are a couple of examples of very basic 3D games that came before Wolfenstein 3D. So Catacomb 3D came slightly before it and used an earlier version of the same game engine. But Wolfenstein is the first version that used basically the complete gaming engine. And also was the first commercially successful product.
Yeah.
And that I credit as being one of the games that put PC gaming actually on the map.
Absolutely.
Because it was a big turning point in PC gaming because that game essentially ran on a potato. Like, you could get a basic 386 with basic VGA graphics.
And even before that, the game was released in 1992.
Yeah.
And a lot of people didn't even have VGA then. Like, you're talking CGA or EGA graphics. And it ran perfectly fine on that sort of hardware.
Yeah, so it was basically a game that proved how far you could push that sort of primitive hardware. I think that's the game that really paved the way for things like Doom, things like Quake. They proved that genre of game would work and that you could actually get good results with not very much hardware.
Yeah. And I think you raise a good point, Tim, that it was really the beginnings of the PC gaming era. A lot of games originally came out for other platforms, whether it be Commodore 64 or the Apple II. And things like that. And Wolfenstein 3D was based on a completely different game by a different developer called Castle Wolfenstein. But that originally came out for the Apple PC or the Apple II back then. And it eventually was ported out to MS-DOS in 1984. But you're right. Like, MS-DOS or PC-based gaming really started to take off in the late 80s and early 90s.
Yeah, and that was one of the games that actually put the PC on the map as finally something that you could use as a serious gaming platform.
Absolutely, because back then, PCs were used for office applications. You're talking word processing and database and all the boring stuff that people didn't really care about too much, or certainly in the home. But in the home, you had your separate gaming console, if you like, whether that was the Commodore 64 or the Atari or something like that. But the PC really started to blur the lines at that point.
And this was even before 3D acceleration and even 2D acceleration.
Absolutely.
Still fairly new. And that's sort of a complex topic as you go into the 90s, because that's when we started to get 3D acceleration. And the situation with standards was, we don't want no fucking standards. So that caused a whole heap of new problems until they realised that using a standard would actually be a bloody good idea.
Yeah. But the problem was too, like, you were severely limited with the hardware of the day. Look, even if 3D acceleration was, a concept, they didn't have the computing power to do it, or certainly nothing that was affordable to the home user in a small enough package.
Yeah,
and the early PCs, they didn't have the audio cards either, I think. I mean,
absolutely, so audio, like, even audio wasn't a thing in early PCs. Yeah, people relied on the PC speaker, which was just a basic single... single tone beeper but then, you know, you got 8-bit audio and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I actually remember the old sort of about the time I started getting to PCs. I remember actually getting seeing a friend put an 8-bit Sound Blaster, so the original Sound Blaster, into his 286, and I was absolutely amazed at what even that was capable of at the time.
Well, and it's funny, you should actually mention sound. Even before the Sound Blaster cards came out, it was possible to produce actually quite good sound just through the parallel port of a PC, through, you know, the things like Cobox speech thing. And I think there was the Disney sound source as well, which operated on a similar sort of concept. And going back to what we were saying before, you can actually buy replicas of the Cobox speech thing that today. So if you wanted to add sound to an old PC that doesn't have a sound card, or you can't get a sound card for, then that was a really real alternative.
Yeah, and interestingly, I kind of found this out recently. So sort of this is another rabbit hole to go down, so I'll try and keep it brief. But you might remember MIDI as being the standard for for basically home recording studios. So that was what the Atari was known for, connecting to keyboards via MIDI for music production. Yep. And MIDI still actually somewhat lives on today. So I was sort of playing around with basically a basic DJ controller at one point. And it sort of surprised me to work out that is essentially just talking MIDI to the computer, and the computer's just picking up, the software is just picking up a MIDI signal. And
absolutely, yeah. And look, MIDI these days is, and I know we're talking about retro computing, so I won't go too far into it, but MIDI these days is a lasting protocol and type of communications for music. And you know, these days you're talking about MIDI over USB and things like that. Like, it's you know, no longer using the joystick port of your computer to control a MIDI device, but it lives on.
Yeah, so that was sort of a little bit of a surprise that actually lives on. Now, one thing I will actually point out, I have put, it's almost a retrospective review of Wolfenstein 3D, sort of looking back at, you know, the fact that, you know, it was just a major breakthrough in gaming when it was released in 1992. Once the show's over and it's uploaded, I will actually be posting it to the Geek Jabber website. So if people want
to... Which you find at...
GeekJabber.com.
The link to GeekJabber.com. Yep. So visit regularly and press like.
Yes. So I will be putting that up.
Like, subscribe.
Yeah, so I will be putting that up because, you know, I'd like to think there's at least some market for people sort of revisiting the old retro stuff. So if you want to have a look at that, yeah, I'll be posting it after the show's done and dusted.
No, that's... that's a really good point, Tim. I think... the more people that get involved in retro computing, just retro technology in general, I think it is a good thing. It really teaches you fundamentals of things like electronics and how things work. If you're willing to learn that sort of thing, it's good. And look, if I can make a shameless plug, Tim, I do encourage people to also check out the EV blog. Dave Jones does some really good content on YouTube and on Odyssey or Library, if you're that way inclined. But check out EV blog. He's done some excellent videos on retro computing and, you know, has torn down various bits of hardware. And then there's a very big following on that sort of thing. So there are people out there still doing, talking about retro computing, which is excellent.
Yeah, so, yeah, and I think it's sort of important just as a... final thing, no, I think it's sort of important to at least somewhat keep the old stuff alive.
Yeah.
I had one of my managers at work ask me years ago why I was interested in retro computing. And part of it was, you know, with the early days of computing, you know, the computers we were using barely pass as pocket calculators now.
Yeah.
They're doing some absolutely amazing things with almost no hardware. But I think it's also important, just from a historical perspective, to just remember that this is what we started with.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, Tim, you raise a really good point. And people these days, you know, even just your average user, they don't realize the complexity and the work that went into making software run on limited hardware. Like if you've got, 64 kilobytes of RAM, and even then, at some point in the past, you were lucky if you even had that. But these days, it seems like, developers just piss away resources, piss away RAM. You know, you've got oodles of hard drive space, you've got gigabytes of RAM. Yeah, so what? But back then, you didn't have that option. RAM and storage was expensive. And every single bit and every single byte mattered.
Yeah, and that's pretty much right. So going back to my first computer, which was the VIC-20, that had a massive 5 kilobytes of memory.
Yeah.
It was sort of like, that was almost useless, but...
But what could you do with 5 kilobytes? Like that's 5 kilobytes of RAM, I should add. Yeah. Like you obviously had your whopping 20 kilobyte ROM. But you could just think, what could people do these days in 5 kilobytes of RAM? And I believe that was expandable too, to a whole 32 kilobytes.
Yeah, it was expandable, although the way that machine worked, that sometimes broke compatibility with some software.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was another topic we could delve down with and spend ages on.
Yeah.
And actually causing compatibility issues.
Absolutely. And I don't think you could even use the full 32 kilobytes. I think some of that was taken up by the basic interpreter as well. So, you know, you're still limited. Yeah. But look, even still, like even if we're talking 32 megabytes, which is, you know, orders of magnitude larger, What do you do in that amount of space? Like your modern smartphone or your smartwatch has more memory than this.
Well, if you put a modern operating system and only give it 32 megs, chances are it's not even going to boot.
Oh, God, no. It won't even install.
Yeah.
But, good times.
But I think it's sort of time to wrap this up, so... Thank you to anyone who has sort of listened into the show. Thank you to anyone in the future who downloads it, because we will be making it available for download. You can always visit us, geekjabber.com, where you can find the website. You can find the article I'm going to put up shortly on Wolfenstein 3D. We've also got our Discord server, Twitter feed, and Patreon. So if you're into any of that, feel free to give any of that a look.
Discord, it's a good way to keep in touch with us too. So if you've got any questions for any of the presenters, either myself or Tim or Quirties, and any of the other guests that we have on, shoot us a message in Discord. We'll get back to you.
Yeah. And
Or just come and hang out in the Discord channel.
Yeah, we don't bite.
Not hard.
Unless, never mind.
Unless you want us to.
Oh dear.
anyway. Yeah, I'd say a dog's bark is worse than his bite.
Yeah, something just like that.
Oh, well. Look, this was a really good trip down memory lane. And I really appreciate it, Tim. Thank you so much. And hopefully,
thanks for the invite.
If there's interest in retro computing, I'm definitely on board. And see where we can take this.
Sounds good. And so that might give us a couple of ideas for future episodes of Geek Jabber Live.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I will bid all of our audience adieu, and thank you for tuning in.
Cheers, Tim. Cheers, Quetties.
Bye-bye.